Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for regular host David Inge. Glad you could listen today. Our producers, by the way, are Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and Henry Frain is managing the controls. When we use the term human rights, we probably think we know what that means. But do we? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the history of the meaning of human rights, some of the people who have tried to define it, and maybe try to find a better understanding of what human rights could mean for the present and the future. Our guest is Belden Fields, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois and author of several books, including his newest, which we will discuss today, Rethinking Human Rights for the New Millennium, published by Palgrave Macmillan. In the book, Belden Fields outlines a number of conceptions of human rights, including many of the contradictions and contests for justice and power these conceptions have inspired. He also proposes a holistic conception of human rights, and we'll talk about what that means and its practical application in the future during this hour. We welcome your questions and comments on the topic. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Anywhere in Champaign County within the 217 area code, 333-9455. If you're outside the 217 area code, anywhere here in the Midwest, or via the internet, anywhere in the U.S., if you're listening online, the toll-free line is 800-222-9455 to join our conversation. Well, good morning, Belden Fields.
Good morning, Jack.
Glad to have you with us.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask to start with, you have been teaching political science for a long time, and I know you've been very concerned personally with issues of human rights. But how did you get interested in it from a theoretical standpoint? What made you decide to write a book on human rights?
Well, I had written in other areas of the discipline, and what really pushed me toward this was a visit by a German colleague to our department, Professor Wolf-Dieter Nahr from Fee University. And Professor Nahr had been writing on human rights for many, many years. He was quite well known in the area, and he was also an editor of the German Human Rights Yearbook. And he urged me to really look at this more deeply and become interested in it. And I forged a personal relationship with Wolf-Dieter. And we cemented, I think, partially because of our own backgrounds, our own personal backgrounds. Wolf-Dieter's father was a minister, and when the Nazis came to power, he rose to a high position in the Nazi Party. And he was in charge of seeing to it that the universities towed the Nazi line. I, on the other hand, came from a Jewish background. My mother's family came from Berlin. Almost all of them were killed by the Nazis. I was raised with a cousin who one of my aunts got out of Germany. His parents were killed, and he and his sister were gotten out, and I was raised with him. So the Holocaust for me was a very, very personal kind of event. And as a result of that, I had developed, frankly, an animosity toward Germans in Germany and the German language, which I heard at home sometimes because my cousin would speak it with his German friends. And Wolf-Dieter and I engaged each other intellectually, but we also engaged each other personally. And when I went over to Berlin the first time, he and I collaborated on a couple of articles. We actually started this book together, but the communications became too difficult across the seas. Wolf-Dieter went with me to the synagogue that some of my relatives had attended, which was attacked during the Kristallnacht. He went with me to the residences, to the business that one of my mother's uncles had run. He went with me to the Jewish cemetery, which was then in East Berlin, to find, and actually he was the one that found it, I couldn't find it, the graves of some of my relatives. And this was very important to me and made me think about my attitude toward Germans and this prejudice that I was holding toward them, kind of, you know, suspecting all Germans of being involved in this. And he was a fascinating person to engage intellectually as well. So I owe him a big debt in terms of my deciding to take a much closer look at what this thing called human rights is all about. It's used very glibly. There was a conference here several years ago on nationalism, and a number of the participants said, well, nationalism would be okay as an ideology as long as it respected human rights. But nobody questioned what that entailed. That seemed to be fairly obvious to the people, whereas nationalism was examined intellectually and so on. So that drove me initially to begin a very in-depth procedure of discovery, intellectual discovery, initially with Wolf Dieter. And we did do a couple of articles together, and then doing this book.
Very interesting. So you have a very, you know, theoretical as well as a very personal connection.
Very personal.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the sources of our ideas about human rights. As you say, it's become, you know, a term that people use. It's almost like a talisman or something that, mm-hmm. that really isn't very clearly defined. But there are people who have thought about it and about rights and how they are defined for the individual. I mean, you mentioned when you were talking about the conference on nationalism and people thought that nationalism would be okay as long as it respected human rights. But maybe there's some kind of there's a right to nationalism, perhaps.
Well, the right to self-determination
is
one of the I mean, there are all kinds of very tricky issues, and the whole issue of secession, which relates to the right to self-determination. I mean, when is that an acceptable thing to do? And is it always acceptable, regardless of the cost to others who have interests in the pre-existing state, and so on? This is one of the arguments that's that I do talk about in the book that I think is really interesting and very difficult to deal with, extremely difficult to deal with.
Sure. Perhaps by looking at some of the ways that they have been dealt with, we can, you know, start to pull the strands of that thread and make greater sense of it. The idea is that you, you start out with the book. There are a few people in particular who try to articulate either a philosophy or political sort of strategy dealing with human rights. And, you know, we could certainly talk about the Magna Carta and some of the early documents. Do those, you know, does that lead us anywhere to a greater understanding by doing that?
Yeah, I think it does. And it does in this sense. My conception of human rights are that they are not abstractions that come out of my head. Now, some people would say that they are God-given. But it's very interesting then to pose the questions, why didn't the Greeks know about that? Were they so different from us that they didn't have human rights? Did they just not recognize that? You know, why is it? Or if we go to the Romans, they had a concept of rights, and as they expanded the Roman Empire, people who were within that empire were extended certain rights. But those were rights that attached to the citizenship, specifically to the Romans. They didn't apply them outside. So the question becomes, what was the historical process and what were the contexts in which we meaning human beings, began to think about human rights? Now, I do talk about the Magna Carta, but in general, the Magna Carta doesn't deal with human rights. What it does is it redistributes power. It was in the 13th century claim against the powers held by the king, and then the lords, the feudal lords, wanted some of that power, and it did go down to all freemen, you know, but it wasn't a universalizing document. It was a document against a heavy concentration of power. So there were interests. There were material interests that were involved. People were interested in protecting their status in the society, securing more power for themselves. Now, that's not an abstract notion. That's very concrete. And then when we get to the 17th century in England, we see a blossoming of the way people begin to think about rights. And that's where I think we can look at the real beginning of the modern human right, both from on the part of certain documents, such as the Petition of Right in England and the English Bill of Rights, to political philosophers like Hobbes and then Locke following Hobbes, but also activists like the Diggers, Winstanley, who make the argument that just because we are human beings, we have a right to use the land that is lying fallow, that is held by the wealthy upper classes, the feudal classes in England. And he states that as a human right, because we are God's creation, we human beings. Now, it's interesting when you look at that century, because what you have is extreme economic hardship. You have wars over religion and the right to religious belief. It's at this time that the Quakers begin to form and other dissident groups. You have arguments over what kinds of government there should be, whether it should be monarchical or whether it should be parliamentary. You have all of these economic and political and religious differences that occur in a particular place in time. So this leads us, as I say, it leads me to say what we have here are a set of human practices. People who feel dominated are making claims that they, as human beings, have a right to overcome that domination. And there were economic dimensions of it from the get-go, the Winstanley argument, access to property. There were political and social implications involved in this, and cultural, if you want to consider the religion a cultural phenomenon.
Well, let's continue to talk about that. We do have a caller to include in our conversation, so let's include them as well. And let me just mention that we're speaking during this hour of Focus 580 with Belden Fields, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, about his book Rethinking Human Rights for the New Millennium. It is a book that includes a lot of the history of the ideas of human rights and also his conception of a holistic view of human rights for the future. We'll talk more about that and take your calls. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a listener on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Yes. Very interesting discussion. I have a question. You talked about the transition to a belief in individual rights. What I'd like to know specifically is when did the belief that those individual rights came from, I don't know, God or nature, rather than being given to individuals by the state? Because my understanding is that Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-American civil rights is based on the idea that people are willing to give up some of their freedoms to receive the protection of the state, but that on the continent, the view was that the government gave people some rights under their supervision. And could you also then connect that to the concept of individual rights in medieval Iceland, which, as far as I understand, was an anarchy with no state, but a semi-feudal system? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I can't do what you... The last thing you asked me about medieval Iceland, if I understood you correctly, you said medieval Iceland.
Yeah.
The relationship between the concept of rights and the state is a very complex one because the modern state is really beginning to form in the 17th century. And you have... Thomas Hobbes, who in my thinking is really the first theorist to talk about human rights, and he limited that right to one right, which was the right to life. Now, in order to secure that right, he wanted an all-powerful state. So in Hobbes's thinking, which, by the way, begins the tradition of liberalism in the sense that he turns the relationship between rights and obligation around. In earlier thinking, you had rights, not human rights, but you had rights so long as you were a dutiful citizen. And once you were not a dutiful citizen, you lost the right. So the priority is with obedience in earlier thinking. With Thomas Hobbes, he makes the argument that your obedience is contingent upon the states respecting your right to life and protecting your right to life. Now, the exchange that he makes is that you give up all your political power. He was very much against democracy and the petition of right. So that's one relationship, the Hobbesian one, which entails an extraordinarily powerful state. He calls it the Leviathan, this, you know, huge, powerful thing. When you move in the next century to Locke, then you get a theory of rights, which is much expanded, focuses on the right to property as an absolute right, and you get the individual in a position where you want to minimize the power of the state, because Locke sees the power of the state as a possible infringement upon the right to private property. So there you get the kind of liberalism that we're more familiar with in our contemporary thinking. But I think you asked a very, very interesting question, because on the one hand, the state is, states are a major violator of human rights. But on the other hand, the notion of human rights comes to us coterminously from a historical point of view with the rise of the nation state. And we see that especially at the end of the 18th century, when we have the U.S. government formed, the Declaration of Independence, and then several years later, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And in the case of France, and after the French Revolution, we have the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen. And these two documents are the first two documents to really clearly enunciate conceptions of rights that everybody has, inalienable rights that everybody has. Now, in these earlier periods, there was a tendency to connect this with natural law and with a religious belief in rights. what I do is I look at also subsequent theorists who argue not on the basis of belief, but try to ground human rights, both on non-rationalist and rationalist grounds, but not on religious grounds. A non-rationalist ground could be sentiment, for example, like Richard Rorty, that, you know, we don't like to see cruelty and we want to minimize cruelty, and that's a basis of rights. And he calls it non-foundationalist because it's not based upon reason, it's based more on sentiment. But then there are a host of other kinds of theories that do try to base it on reason. What I do, which is why mine is a holistic one, is those theories tend to point to a single value. They ground it on freedom or agency. They ground it on equality. They ground it on human needs, or in the case of Habermas, discursive inclusiveness. I argue for a plurality of values upon which human rights are grounded, not just one of these values.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot in there we could follow up on. We do have another caller, so let's include them in our conversation and go from there. Listener on line number 4 is next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. You know, under consideration now in the Supreme Court is the campaign reform law passed by our Congress, signed by our president, which will restrict political speech contrary to the First Amendment. During the deliberations on that campaign reform law in the Congress, there was an amendment proposed that nothing in this campaign reform law will contravene the free speech guarantees of the First Amendment.
Well, you're talking about political spending, though, right?
Well, that's right. But political spending, the Supreme Court has in the past said that political spending and political speech are quite closely identified.
Well, this is the issue,
yeah,
isn't it?
Indeed, but the point is here that when an amendment was proposed in the Congress, now remember that every member of the Congress has taken an oath to defend the Constitution, and when an amendment was proposed that nothing in this campaign reform law will contravene the free speech guarantees of the First Amendment,
okay,
that amendment was voted down.
Okay, I get your point, I think.
Now, in contrast to that, the Supreme Court recently made sodomy a constitutional right. Congress nor any legislature may pass a law against sodomy, jeopardizing defense of marriage, which is hugely popular. Now, here's the question. Which constitutional right now stands on the strongest ground? Which constitutional right is strongest right now? Right to free speech or the right to sodomy?
Well, first of all, I don't understand the question. I mean, if you've made clear that you think that these are wrong, but I don't see the relationship. I don't think any sensible connection can be drawn that way. Let me say also that I disagree with treating campaign spending as speech. It is much more than that. It's using scarce resources to exercise power within the society, and in a way that is certainly much more than speech. When I go and cash a check at the bank, I may be free to do that, but I don't see that as involving any human right. It's a transaction, and I get something for it, and that's what people who contribute to campaigns do. In the regard to sodomy, we do have conceptions of the right to privacy, which are very important rights. We don't want the government intruding into bedrooms. If you carry your logic through, you're going to wind up with a totalitarian system. And I don't think that totalitarian systems are human rights respecting in any sense.
The questions of the caller, especially the sodomy issue, does get to the sort of the conflict people have over individual rights versus community rights, or, you know, moral rights, you know, the right of a community to impose standards. And perhaps, you know, these are things that sort of the kind of conflicts are inevitable in any kind,
sure,
of any kind of society.
Sure, sure. yeah, I think that they are inevitable. But when we talk about human rights, we are committing ourselves to a proposition that there are certain things that communities cannot do, even if the majority in the community wants to prohibit certain things or impose certain things. If we take a strictly majoritarian point of view, then, and if that's how we're going to define democracy, then we might as well forget about human rights, because the majority can do anything to the minority. So you've got that issue, and then you've got the privacy issue in the case of sodomy.
That's a very interesting point you just made, because I think a lot of people in this country still don't quite see how that would play out. If, in, you know, we think of democracy as essentially, you know, one person, one vote, majority rules. But as you say, if we do that, then the minority always loses. And where you have, you know, intergroup conflicts, the smaller group is always going to lose.
That's right. And that's why we have constitutions. And one of the characters that I talk about of the modern state is constitutionalization, to see that, to try to make sure that minorities are not, you know, ridden roughshod. And then a second mechanism, is human rights, where nations can be called, governments can be called to account beyond their national boundaries. And there is another set of limits that human rights imposes. So you have national constitutions and human rights. Now, they are related in the sense I pointed out that the U.S. Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitutions were human rights documents, in that there were universalized human rights, and also some of the some of the provisions of the constitutions and the amendments, and I think the most important, some of the most important ones, habeas corpus, due process of law, and the 14th Amendment applies to citizens and non-citizens alike. So, yes, we have to accept certain limitations, or we have to give up the notion of human rights, and probably civil rights as well.
We're a little past our midpoint here in our conversation with Belden Fields, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at University of Illinois. We're talking about some of the ideas in his book, Rethinking Human Rights for the New Millennium. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I want to get at some of the later thinking that that you detail in the book, in particular the notion of three generations of rights that sort of extend beyond this Hobbesian view of, you know, individual right to life, and then take into account more political and civil rights, and then move beyond that to talk about rights to peace, the environment, and right. things like that.
Right. Well, the categorization, the political and civil rights are obvious. Your right to vote, your right to speak, the right of the press to operate, right to participate in elections. But then there are also economic and social rights. Now, in the particularly in the Anglo-American world, and especially after 1980, there's a bit tendency to deny those rights and to try to limit human rights to the political and civil rights. Actually, right after the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt talked about economic rights as being important. Economic rights in the sense of economic rights for the vast majority of the people, not just private property rights or corporate rights, but for the vast majority of the people. And Eleanor Roosevelt, when she was on the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations, appointed by Harry Truman, also proposed that these be accepted. And if you look at the UN Declaration of Human Rights of 48, you find both of the economic and social and the political and civil rights are encoded in the Declaration. It was decided, the declaration was a General Assembly declaration, and it was decided that they wanted to incorporate these into international law, and that would require drafting these as covenants. So there was an attempt to put these together in one covenant, the political and civil and the economic and social. And it didn't work because by that time, the West became suspicious of the motives here of the Soviet Union and the Third World, because they felt the Third World might make claims as a result of colonization of social and economic rights, that they had something coming to them as a payment for colonization. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in 1980, we had the Reagan administration, and the only economic right they recognized was the rights of corporation. That was also the only group right they recognized, because the great debates, two of the great debates in human rights, so are there anything beyond political and economic rights? And some argued, no, that muddies the water, that they become too numerous and thus less effective. and the second great discussion is whether groups and collectivities can have human rights as well as individuals have human rights. Now, what I argue in the book is that you cannot divide the political and civil human rights from the economic and social human rights. If people are starving, then what good are the political rights mm-hmm. to them? These cannot be divided. And my view is also the view which is shared in Europe and shared in the European Union takes this view in its documents as well, and shared in what used to be called the Third World, the South. The United States, Jimmy Carter signed the Economic and Social Convention in 1966, but the Senate has refused to ratify it. So we're one of the odd men out in terms of world opinion and consensus on human rights consists of. The issue, all right, let me just mention the rights of everybody as well, right to peace, right not to have nuclear tests, which contaminate the whole world and so on. That's not codified in conventions.
Yeah, good.
The second argument is, as I say, this one over whether groups can have rights. And my argument is very simply this. If we talk about genocide, the right to be free of genocide, genocide involves not just killing random individuals. It means trying to destroy a people and a culture, and those people and a culture have a human right not to be destroyed. There is a right to development in one of the documents, and explicitly says it's at the individual and at the level of a people. So I argue in my book that both collectivities and individuals have human rights. What I don't argue is that collectivities have human rights, which are completely separated from rights of individuals, but you can't reduce the one to the other.
Okay. We'll talk more about that. We have a couple calls to include, and we'll do that. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello, Professor Fields. I'm curious to know how you would go about responding to many who argue that the idea of human rights and a term that's used closely right after that, universal rights, is essentially a non-Western idea and that it is incompatible with communitarian or aboriginal or tribal customs. And are you also acquainted with how John Rawls, in his last book, Law of Nations, might respond to that?
No, on the latter point. Now, I got a little confused by the way you phrased your question.
There are non-Western thinkers who challenge the advocacy of human rights
yes.
to non-Western cultures, for example, on the grounds that this advocacy is incompatible with Aboriginal or tribal or communitarian.
I do try to answer that in the book. First of all, I have a very interesting quote from a Zulu aphorism that talks about human rights. I have quotes from Native Americans. I have notes from African American slaves in the book, which are, while they don't mention, although Frederick Douglass did talk in terms of rights and came very close to human rights talk, they have analog conceptions to what I talk about in my holistic notion of human rights. My holistic notion of human rights is not as individualistic as a lot of the particularly American and British thinkers' notion of human rights. So I see my notion of human rights, because it does include group and collective rights, because it does include social and economic rights, as more enabling in terms of cross-cultural dialogue. Moreover, I don't think we should consider cultures monolithic. There are also non-Western writers who are very supportive of the idea of human rights, and there are Western writers that are very antagonistic to the idea of human rights. So I don't think that the divide is clear, and I talk a lot about that in my book, an awful lot about that.
Without such a conception of rights, minority critics within a culture often are put at a disadvantage.
Right, absolutely, yes. I mean, they need that very much. I think, you know, I'm all for groups that want to be self-determining, making their claims to self-determination, but I wouldn't grant those claims to self-determination unless those groups granted people the right to difference within the group that they're determining. So I think this is a complex issue, but as I say, in the book, I really try to go into considerable depth in dealing with that kind of issue. And what I don't want to see is, you know, the hard line, the hard Anglo-American dominant line that, you know, we've got it right in the West. It applies just to individuals. It applies only to political and civil rights. And you either accept that or you don't accept that. I think conceptually it's wrong, and I try to argue in the book, and I think it's disastrous in terms of having the human rights conception accepted universally.
Well, I'll go read your book. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, there's a lot there, and, you know, there is a lot that we could talk about that we're not going to get to. I want to make sure that we do, however, get to at least a partial discussion of your holistic approach to human rights. And you mentioned this Zulu aphorism, which you reproduce at least in
yes.
part in the book. This is, quite frankly, very moving to
it
read.
Is.
It
is.
Really is. And
you want to read it?
Well, it is a little bit long. Maybe we could. Actually, I was thinking about reproducing it on our website if people want
that'd
to look at
great.
It.
That'd be great.
I think that'd be a way to go with that. But the root of it seems to be the potential for human development.
Yes. Yes. That's really where I start. And human beings are unique in that they have potential for development intellectually, emotionally, creatively. But this is always developed within a web of social relationships. And this is where I reject at the very base this strong, strong, strong individualism that, you know, I worked it, I made it, I earned it, I worked for it, I get to keep it, to hell with anybody else. This is always done within a web of social relationships. And it comes about as a result of what I call Cohen self-determination. That I, within these web of social relations and working with other people, being affected by other people, am determining myself and the communities and families and relations, other structures that I'm involved in. But I do this within a context, a certain material and cultural context. And that material, cultural context is extremely important. Again, that's why I talk in the beginning of the book about the 17th century. What was going on there was why these people came up with these notions. There were changes in class structure. There were changes in political organization. There were changes in religious commitments, cultural changes. And the barriers to this kind of development is what I call domination. And the attempt to break through domination and to be able to develop oneself are struggles for human rights, in my mind. So this is a bottom-up view. I'm looking at the people who are raising the issue and saying my rights are being violated, rather than looking from the top down here in terms of who gives people rights, but rather the struggles for human rights across history are what interest me, and this is what creates the rights. The rights emerge out of these concrete struggles. There are three values. I said I don't accept a single value. What I do accept are the values that come out of the French Revolution explicitly: liberty, equality, and instead of fraternity, I talk about solidarity. I think it's really important that solidarity not be taken out. Some of our major Western thinkers, including Jack Donnelly and Michael Ignatieff, who are major thinkers, make the argument that human rights cannot be based in any way on solidarity. I think that's wrong. We have to have solidarity in there with other people. And then I have another concept, which is social recognition. Social recognition kind of binds liberty, equality, and solidarity. What people who are arguing for rights are is they're arguing for a social recognition, for people to recognize them as human beings with possibilities for development, whose freedom, whose equality, and whose demands for solidarity must be met if human rights are to be expected. That's just a quick thumbnail sketch of what I call a holistic notion, and I think this resonates not only in the West, maybe not so much in the United States. I'm running against the current in the United States, but I'm used to doing that, but also in Europe and in the rest of the world.
There's a lot there to talk about. We have several callers, so let's include them in our conversation. We'll go next to a listener on a cell phone on line number two. Good morning.
Hi. I called earlier. I wanted to ask you a follow-up question on what you were just speaking about, deals exactly with that. First, I would like to say you're very articulate and well-spoken and enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'm a libertarian, and I was basically brought up on the natural rights theory, natural law foundation. Mm-hmm. And the problem I have is this. You can either base rights on utilitarianism or on some part of human nature. If you base it, or on God, those seem to be the three choices. If you base it on human nature, and you're talking about the concept of potentiality, then you're really going back all the way to Aristotle, who talked about potentiality and talked about apparent good and then real good, and which ones you had a right to have, which ones they could take away from you because they really didn't make you a better person. But what I wonder about is this. I live in the woods, and I see chipmunks being eaten by owls all the time. And nobody claims that they have rights from other, one species has a right relative to another species. Why do human beings have rights other than just wanting to say, I want this right, and that's why I have it? Why do human beings have rights, and animals don't seem to have any amongst themselves? And that's my question, so let me hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I think the answer to that is that human rights is a moral conception. And I think we don't impose that. And precisely because we do have this capacity for development, an important part of that is what we call morality. When we look at other species, I don't think that we think of them as having morality. They have instincts. They try to avoid pain. They are driven by certain things. But I think that I would confine the concept. And by the way, I think they have rights. They don't have human rights. But I think we as human beings, because we are moral human beings, have to recognize their right not to be exposed to unnecessary suffering, whatever. But I think the difference is that we are moral creatures, and the concepts that we deal with, whether it's human rights or whether it's justice, democracy, those make sense only if we're talking about a moral universe, and I just don't think it's there with the animals. Our obligation to treat animals in a certain way is there, but I don't think we expect them to be moral beings.
Okay. Hope that gets to the question. We have a couple of the callers and just about maybe 7 minutes left. Let's include some other listeners. Next, someone in Champaign County on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Let me extend the rights of animals discussion a bit. There are animals that are considered now to be sentient, and you'd certainly include dolphins, perhaps whales and chimpanzees and gorillas. And if they have sentience, a conception of rights perhaps would need to include them in some way.
I do. I do, of rights, but not of human rights.
Dividing human rights from animal rights may not be possible when you're talking. I think you allow diversity of human belief and thought in regard to rights. Perhaps simply because of our inadequacy, we don't know what their concept of rights might be, if we can even talk about concept in the same way.
Yeah, well, this is
because dolphins might conceptualize things in radar images and things of that sort.
Right, and I think the question is a good one. I don't want to turn this into a whole program on animal rights, but I think that your point is well made. And I would also pose the question: what does that mean? Because you know, are you going to give dolphins the right to vote and to participate in property ownership? I mean, it's a difficult thing to. We could spend a lot of time talking about those things, but.
Well, let me just say this. It's precisely because the animals are sentient that I do think we as human beings have to respect their rights, but they're not human rights.
Okay. We might continue that conversation on another program, though, so we'll retain that option. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign County, also on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to know if you treat – you talked about social, human, and economic rights. I wanted to know how you treat something called the right to communicate as tied up all in the UNESCO defunding during the Reagan era, and the idea that it sort of bridges between – to my mind, between individual and social rights, the idea being that groups and individuals, not only do they have a right to free speech, but in some sense, they have a right to be heard and tell their stories. At least this is in one of the battery of UN accords, and I think it's probably ones that are not signed by the U.S., but I'd like for you to address that, and I'll hang up since it's short on time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I don't treat it specifically in the book in the way that you have stated it, but I think it certainly would be. One of the things that I do talk is about how those who argue just for political rights and for arguing that they are just individual rights are off base. And I go back to John Stuart Mill and his discussion of free speech. And you can say, well, I as an individual have the right to free speech. But John Stuart Mill just doesn't argue that you as an individual have a right to free speech. He argues that society as a whole has a right to hear your speech and that it's not just a matter of an individual right. And in fact, he does curtail some individual rights beyond what libertarians would want, despite the fact that the book on liberty is seen as the major one of the major statements historically of this. So the argument that I make is that when you make these real distinctions between individual and group rights, the situation is often much more complex than it seems. And I think your point is an indication of that.
We just have literally about a minute and a half left, and there's a lot more we're not going to be able to get to, and one caller I'm going to have to, you know, unfortunately not be able to include. But I do want to, you know, sort of throw out the notion that this is not really, it's been a very interesting conversation, but it's not just academic. We're talking about stuff that really matters. If we claim to stand for human rights, we better know what we're standing for.
Oh, absolutely. I think we do. And I must say, I'm not just an academic. I am the co-coordinator of the Living Wage Movement, and I regard my activity as being one that is directed toward economic human rights of working people to earn a fair and livable wage that's codified in the human rights documents, international documents. I've been involved in the civil rights movement. I don't think I could have written this book, actually, if I were purely an academic. And indeed, there's a postscript in there, one of the postscripts that deals with a situation in Decatur, Illinois, the Staley.
And also a postscript on the response to 9/11.
Yes, a postscript to 9/11. Yeah. And those go beyond the purely academic.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there since we're out of time here. I do want to suggest for folks that if you'd like to follow up on this and read more, the book is Rethinking Human Rights for the New Millennium. The author, A. Belden Fields, he's been our guest. He's an emeritus professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. And the book, once again, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Okay. Belden Fields, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Jack.